You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 29th of November 2017 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Tuck. On today's show,
a missile was launched a little while ago from North Korea. I will only tell you that we will take care of it. We have General Mattis in the room with us, and we've had a long discussion on it. It is a situation that we will handle.
North Korea announces on state television that it's achieved its mission to become a nuclear state with a missile that can reach the whole of the United States. My guests, James Rogers and Carlo Bonura, will be discussing this in the day's other top stories, including the release of a detained Saudi prince accused of corruption. An Iranian wrestler has admitted losing last year to avoid facing an Israeli opponent. And we'll discuss some similar sporting controversies from the past too. And finally, as the V&A in London expands for the first time outside of the UK to the Chinese city of Shenzhen, we'll ask how successful such cultural exports can be. That's all to come on Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck. So welcome to Midori House. My guests today are James Rogers, who's Head of International Journalism Studies at City University here in London, and Carla Bonura, who's a Senior Teaching Fellow in the Department of Politics and International Studies at SOAS, also here in London. Welcome both to the programme. Now we're going to start the show in North Korea, which announced on state television that it's become a nuclear state with a missile that they say could potentially reach the whole of the United States. It's not the first time that Pyongyang has hinted that its missiles could reach the US, but the tone seems more confident than ever before. President Trump says that the US will take care of it. Now, we have had many of these stories, and perhaps we've become a little bit, you know, weary of the claims and the counterclaims, but actually even the South Koreans are saying today that they think this is correct, this is a successful test, and it does seem to have gone further than ever before. Carlo, what should we take away? Is this a more alarming moment?
I think this is part of a pattern of diplomatic retaliation, I guess you could argue. The U.S. put North Korea on the terror watch list, you know, on the list of states that sponsor terrorism, and this missile launch could be seen as a response to that. What's interesting for me is that if you look at the way in which the Trump administration has changed in its ability to calibrate a response to North Korea, at the beginning of the administration, when he would say things like, we'll take care of that, and he had all this bravado, there was nothing there. But now the administration has a fairly substantial diplomatic mission to tighten the sanctions regime. And as a result, you could argue, even though they're completely powerless to stop these missile tests, in fact, their efforts to try to increase the pressure on North Korea are far more substantial than they were at the very beginning. To be honest, I don't think that Donald Trump could articulate that. And I think that that's the job of Rex Tillerson and the other cabinet members to really try to put together a coherent strategy to increase the sanctions or to tighten the sanctions regime.
Now, and just on that, there was a suggestion today that they would tighten the sanctions yet again. What is there left to tighten the sanctions on? What would be the next things to be targeted?
I think it's important to realize that when we talk about sanctions against rogue states, to use the now antiquated term, what we have to remember is that these sanctions regimes are never completely airtight. And what's amazing is that up until the death, the assassination of Kim Jong-nam earlier this year, almost every single Southeast Asian nation had both diplomatic relations and financial relations with North Korea. And what we find now is that although Malaysia and Singapore have tightened and kind of dropped these relations, we have countries like Myanmar and Thailand where it's completely unclear exactly what the financial relationship is with there. So I think the most important thing to do would be rather than looking at individual items that could be targeted for sanctions, the Trump administration has to focus on these states that simply aren't following them.
James, this notion of we'll take care of it, as Carlo was saying, that actually, that you know, he hasn't done much to take care of it, and it's a very complicated diplomatic game. He's playing two hands at once. He's playing this kind of, you know, I'll be your buddy, come round and we'll watch baseball together. Plus, I'll thump you if you don't do what you want. And it is quite unclear whether he believes both are possible successful tactics at dealing with the North Koreans. What's your feeling? What could come next?
I think the overall thing one has to, I think one would observe here is this is only heading in one direction. I mean, if indeed this test is more successful from a North Korean point of view than any which has preceded it, then Mr. Trump may say we'll deal with this, but they're going to have to deal with this at some point. And I think one thing that one can say of Mr. Trump's approach to diplomacy as his approaches his first anniversary in office, it is this: he has tried to bring from his time in the business world some of the skills which he acquired there or which he used there, and only some of them are actually transferable. And it is a much more complicated game. He portrays himself as a deal maker, but diplomacy is much more complex than that often. And I think in some ways, you know, he seems to be out of his depth, because at the same time as trying to say we're going to deal with this and inspiring confidence domestically, hopefully from his point of view, he's still engaging in these childish sort of teenage boy Twitter spats as well. And we saw another example today, not on North Korea, but one relating to the UK. So I think there are questions over this. And I think, as Carlo says, you know, the real decision making may be amongst those members of the cabinet with greater military and diplomatic experience.
Does he have a point, though, that, you know, he's been put in a position where, you know, the game has gone too far almost for him to do that much about it? You know, the Obama administration, perhaps they could have done more. So he's now left in this situation where it could be, you know, a military action that takes place. And we know that the South Koreans say that don't do that, because if that happens, we would lose hundreds of thousands of people, even in the best scenario. But on the other hand, you know, appeasement, it makes you think of, you know, dictators in the past. Appeasement doesn't seem to work either with him.
Appeasement doesn't work, and like I said a second ago, that it was under the Obama administration's watch that this sanction regime had so many holes. I think I just cannot imagine what a military solution to the Korean problem.
Well, solution is kind of the wrong word in this. You know, there would be military action, but a solution feels far from a pleasant word to use in this connection.
I know, but I think that's the problem, is that for the Trump administration, they believe that this is a problem to be solved. I think that's the danger.
Yeah. James, do you fear that there could be a strike?
I think it's possible. I mean, I think Mr. Trump's supporters and those who agree with the line that he's trying to take would point to the fact that, you know, for the last sort of 20 plus years that various successive US administrations have tried to solve this problem, or at least to make it work better. It hasn't worked. We are where we are today. I mean, one remembers in the 1990s when, as part of deals, food aid was sent. Then apparently North Koreans were portraying this domestically as sort of tributes that were being paid to atone for the insults which the United States had thrown at the country. And I think it is going to be very difficult to see. And also one has to remember, and many analysts have pointed this out, that one of the current regime in North Korea's motivations is they're looking at what happened to Saddam Hussein and Muammar Gaddafi, who apparently abandoned their weapons programs only to suffer the fates which they did.
Just before we move on, Carlo, you know, you come from an academic world, and, you know, in the academic world, for decades now, they've been saying, look, the notion of history being about great men, and, you know, we have to move away from that. It's about economics. It's about, you know, all these other theories. But boringly, when you come down to these stories, you know, you're left wondering what the personalities of two people are in the world, and that these two people's, you know, awful personalities, one way or the other, are going to decide the fate of the world in a way.
Yeah. I think in terms of one thing that I was going to mention a second ago, in terms of the timing of Trump's administration, is that it does coincide with Kim Jong-un's rise to power. And so although he inherited a problem, in fact, he also has recently inherited a new partner in this game, which is a relatively inexperienced partner in this game. So both of them, the similarity possibly is that they're slightly inexperienced at this, and I agree that that makes things far more dangerous.
Well, we're going to move now to Saudi Arabia, which released Prince Miteb bin Abdullah after 3 weeks of detention on alleged charges of corruption. Miteb was a contender to the throne and paid a settlement of more than $1 billion for his release. Now, James, you were in Saudi earlier this month, just ahead of this sweep that rounded up all these royals. It feels oddly like, you know, hanging someone out of the window and upside down and shaking their pockets to see what falls out. And they're doing pretty well at getting money off these people.
It seems to be. I mean, interestingly, I was there just at the beginning of this month. When I returned, I had a couple of private conversations here in London with some quite well-placed sources who suggested that those people who had been detained, albeit in a luxury hotel, but detained nevertheless, were those people suspected of having done rather well out of corrupt business dealings. Certainly the Crown Prince has portrayed this as his drive against corruption. But it seemed that the private understanding was that were some of those people detained willing to reach an accommodation with the authorities, they might then be prepared to leave. And this is, I think, probably sending two messages. One, that things will not go on as they did before. And secondly, you need to cooperate. I mean, the Crown Prince, Mohammed bin Salman, is really, it's an astonishing moment in the country's history, really. He's made these great reformist pronouncements. He is a young man in his early 30s, assuming that, you know, he becomes king at some point before too long. One looks at the prospect of his having, you know, depending on how long he lives, up to half a century as an absolute monarch of this country. I mean, a mandate and a possibility for reform that nobody really else in the world could dream of. So I think it's a very interesting moment. And the impression I had, not having visited the country before, and I was only there for 4 days, so I don't claim any huge insight, but I did feel, I was actually slightly reminded when, as a young journalist, I visited the Soviet Union, the end of the Soviet Union. It was people very, very keen to engage with outsiders in a way that I hadn't really experienced since. So I think there is a sense that the country is opening to the world, and this is part of showing the way that it's going to do business. That said, we've heard stories of investors and business people from around the world very concerned because their partners have been close to this, you know, anti-corruption.
Yeah, because we have a piece in the upcoming forecast issue of the magazine where a Saudi woman has written a piece about just the notion of looking at the news from Saudi Arabia every morning at the moment. And she expresses a notion of excitement that she, you know, it's a bit of a PR move as well, but, you know, finally allowing women to drive, for example. But when you spoke to people in Saudi, did they have this, younger people have this sense that this was a good thing? Because on the outside, there's lots of kind of questions, you know, is he authoritarian or is he a genuine reformer? But what was the feeling when you spoke to people?
I mean, I would hesitate to draw any widespread conclusions from those contacts which I had. I was talking to a group of journalists. I spent 3 or 4 days at a workshop and conference with them. But I did sense that they were very open, and people were generally, I mean, one would expect in a country like that you're not going to hear any sort of overt criticism of the monarchy. But people did seem generally enthusiastic and seemed generally keen that, if, you know, part of this was, you know, allowing Western journalists and academics like me to go and talk, then it was probably a good thing. I think too, I mean, if you look at you know, probably what the strategy involves, you know, there are also talks about opening places of entertainment, which, you know, maybe part of a way. There is very little to do in Saudi Arabia, you know, compared to many other places, because certainly the interpretation of Islam, which has prevailed for the last 3 decades or so, and the Crown Prince himself has referred to this, has tended against places of entertainment. So I think there's a sense that, you know, for younger people, there may be opportunities which have been closed to them so far, and were indeed to their parents' generation.
Carlo, again, it's another interesting character who we're trying to judge oddly from the outside. Another, you know, not closed in the way of North Korea, but another slightly closed nation. And if it wasn't for the war in Yemen, I think that maybe many people in the West would be kind of cheering, thinking that he was an out-and-out reformer. But we know that this is also part of a much bigger geopolitical game. What's your reading of the man and his moves so far?
I think that it's it is I wouldn't say problematic to use the word reforma, but we certainly have to use it with some awareness that, in fact, this might be it's some of the language that he's used and some of the things that he's done already is to appeal to an international audience, you know, the political elite in the North Atlantic to ensure, to reassure them that they're not going to get another king, which is, who is thoroughly supportive of kind of maintaining the Wahhabi state that exists now. But I think it is, we already see inklings of what, in terms of Saudi Arabia's foreign policy, what this might mean. There are many reports that he is very supportive of being far more aggressive toward Iran, that the Saudi...
And which plays into a nice line with both Washington and Jerusalem as well.
Mm. Yeah, and there has actually been some discussion of possible new Saudi-Israeli alliance in the region against what they see as a kind of Iranian encroachment in Lebanon and Syria. So, I think you're absolutely right. Yemen is a huge problem. The foreign policy against Qatar is an early signal that he's trying to establish a kind of regional reputation as being hard on Iran or hard on those players in the region that won't line up to the Saudi Saudi vision for the region. Domestically, it's going to be very fascinating because he still has to work out how to deal with the religious elite that has been thoroughly empowered in the country.
And James, you know, for even a country which has a reasonably nuanced foreign policy like the UK, you know, Theresa May's just been engaging with the Saudis. There's not much that she can do. You know, we sell them a lot of arms. Mm. We're heavily involved with the Saudis at many levels of business. She's not in a position to say, look, I don't like what you're doing or I do like what you're doing. She's got to nod and be polite, hasn't she?
Yeah, the British government has been rather good at that for a very long time. And I think the other reason why, of course, why people have maintained such good relations with Saudi Arabia is oil. And I think one thing which the Crown Prince does seem to have his eye on is the fact that that isn't going to last forever. And even if it were to last forever, then the demand for it was not going to stay the same. And I think this is going to be a big, 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 big factor in the future international relations of those countries who've done rather well out of it. You might have seen recently that what was called Davos in the desert, when the Crown Prince invited all these investors and business heads, plan to build this city which is going to be sort of oil free, running on solar energy, you know, very much trying to look to the future and saying we're not necessarily about our, you know, our oil past.
Well, it's another fascinating place and, as we said, another slightly closed world. So great to have both James Rogers and Carlo Bonura there talking about those two stories. But coming up next, we're going to look at a Bosnian Croat war criminal and how he died after drinking poison in a UN courtroom.
This Christmas, alongside established Monocle favourites to place under the tree, why not treat your friends and loved ones to some of our new collaborations? A truly fragrant festive treat comes courtesy of Monocle Alpine by Trez. Our friends from Südtirol have developed a line of products from shampoo to face cream that will transport you to the serene surroundings of northern Italy. Combining sleek, lightweight design with robust Spanish workmanship, the items in the Monocle Leather Collection are produced and manufactured in collaboration with Comme des Garçons. We've also teamed up with the US brand Topo to rework a selection of their classic pieces. Topo have fused traditional style with modern functionality to develop rucksacks and pouches made using Cordura nylon fabric and a coated pack cloth lining. And they're available exclusively to Monocle. So happy shopping and a very happy Christmas from everyone at Monocle.
You're back with Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck, and also still with me, of course, are James Rogers and Carlo Bonura. Well, at The Hague today, a Bosnian war criminal died after drinking poison shortly after his 20-year sentence for war crimes, issued in 2013, was upheld by the court. The former commander, Slobodan Prajak, refused to sit down and shouted that he rejected the verdict, stating he was not a war criminal, before apparently drinking from a vial of what he said was poison. Carlo, an extraordinary piece of theatrics, and he certainly caught the world's attention. And I'm sure there's going to be many questions about how he got hold of this file. But what do we know about the man and why he got to this position?
Well, he was involved in in war crimes back in 1993, or was accused of war crimes after he destroyed an Ottoman bridge. What's most important about this story is that this is, if I'm not mistaken, the end of the process. He's the last person to be tried. And for these, like as you said, these theatrics to take place at this very last moment, it will make him a hero in the eyes of Croat nationalists. And this is certainly... It just demonstrates how these international proceedings are not always the best way to try to seek justice.
James, one or two people comment today that it's the nature of the man, that he was a controlling figure who liked to be in charge of the moment, and he was unused in recent years to being locked up. And this was him, in a way, kind of proving that something about his personality. What can we read into his actions, do you think?
Well, I think, one always uses the phrase show trial in a slightly different sense, but in this sense, I think some of the accused at this war crimes tribunal have used it as just that, as a sort of platform to stage things like this. I mean, presumably, in this case, if the accused or the convicted criminal, as he was, had got access to the poison, he could have taken it somewhere else. But it was very, very, very much a sort of public way of doing it. I mean, as a correspondent, I covered Slobodan Milosevic's trial at The Hague too, and that had very much strong elements of theatricality, and with him breaking into English occasionally to sort of contradict the judge who was addressing him in English and then speaking in Serbian, but very much using this as a tribune from which to make his points. And I think, but as you say, there will be huge questions about how somebody, in such a high security prison was able to acquire poison, if indeed that's what's happened, but certainly there's strong circumstantial evidence that it was what it claimed to be.
And Carla, just before we move on from this, it's fascinating that even now, if you go to, Serbia and you go to Belgrade, you'll meet cool people who live an international life. But actually, in all of these countries that are from the former Yugoslavia, still really powerful nationalist parties in all of them, who are one step away from causing problems at all sorts of moments. And today, after this death, we've seen all sorts of people coming out of the woodwork saying this has been because of the unfair treatment of him during the Hague trials, etc., etc. So even now, we haven't got to a nice patchwork of independent countries from the former Yugoslavia.
That's right. And I think that just to look at this more broadly, if you look at the mechanisms that were in place to produce that patchwork of nations, it was on the one hand European Union membership, mm-hmm. and on the other it was this continued geopolitical pressure from the U.S. and the coalition that carried out bombings of Belgrade. And I think that one of the not to steer the conversation in too far a direction, but one of the consequences of Europe losing its political project and simply being an economic project is that there is no alternative to this type of nationalism. Right. There's nothing about Europe as a political project which would allow us to kind of disarm subnational nationalisms and this type of ethnic attachment.
Well, we move on because the Iranian wrestler Alireza Karimi Makiani has admitted to losing a match on purpose to avoid competing against an Israeli competitor. At the under-23 World Championships in Poland, he was heading for an easy victory against his Russian opponent until his coach shouted at him to lose. It's not the first time that this happened in his career, and with another similar episode back in 2013, Iran forbids its athletes to compete with Israelis. James, if you don't want to compete with any other nation, whatever country you come from, you shouldn't really be bothering to turn up, should you?
Well, I think you just have to hope this doesn't happen, as presumably this competitor did on this occasion. I mean, I was thinking about this. It must be very, very frustrating for a number of athletes. One thinks of Olympic boycotts in certain countries. You don't have very long at the top of your game, whatever your game is, certainly in terms of international games. So it must be very frustrating. But in this case, politics has clearly trumped any sort of sporting ambition, which the country, Iran in this case, case had. And I think, yes, perhaps you shouldn't compete, but I think in this case you just have to hope that the situation isn't going to arise. But in the case of this particular match, it did.
Carlo, any empathy with the man or with his coach? Because I presume this runs a long trail back to Tehran, because the coach is probably scared of what people in the sports ministry will say, and everyone puts a little bit of pressure down the line.
Yeah, I don't want to be too cynical here, but I thought this was a perfectly written geopolitical parable in which the Russian is defeated, right? He defeats his Russian opponent outright. By the Iranian, the Israeli is the regional power, but the conflict never comes. It's held in tension, and most importantly for the American audience that's going to read this, it is the single Iranian wrestler who's going to feel that, you know, this tragic figure who never gets to achieve his goal. And I mentioned prior to this that we even have the sad music that the wrestler plays the morning after the defeat. So I think this is classic New York Times, to be honest.
Well, it has been a fascinating story. We're going to sneak in one final story, though, because London's Victoria and Albert Museum, the V&A as it's known, is unveiling its first gallery outside of the UK this week. The new edition will be located in the Chinese city of Shenzhen, and it's designed by the veteran Japanese architect Fumihiko Maki. This sort of expansion is familiar gambit for many cultural institutions, with the well-known cases such as the Guggenheim being followed with fresher examples, such as the Louvre, which recently opened a huge new museum in Abu Dhabi. Now, the museum in Abu Dhabi, James, has had mixed reviews, and people are still unsure exactly whether it's going to be a success. They're renting the name, I think, for like 30-odd years. The clock has been ticking for many. Is it good to build these brand outposts or not?
That's one of those questions that one can only really judge probably 30 years down the line, isn't it?
I mean, I think we'll come back in 30 years. Yeah. We'll still be here, I think.
I think one can admire the ideas behind it. I mean, sometimes these sort of international expansions do run into trouble. For example, you know, there are political difficulties further down the line. One thinks perhaps of some cases of universities expanding and setting up branches overseas, which don't always work out. But I think in terms of, you know, in an increasingly globalized world, then, you know, why not? Why not export Western art to China and build ties in that way? But yes, of course, you know, it's almost without precedent probably in human history that one museum will set up a branch somewhere else. But I think we can probably expect to see more of this in the future. And provided that, you know, political and commercial ties continue to flourish, it will probably work very well. It just depends when those ties come under tension.
Carlo, the Guggenheim in Bilbao was seen as a big success. You know, it brought a bit of American swagger and, you know, brought Frank Gehry to Europe in a big way. And it has been adopted by the Basques and made their own. The Louvre seems to be a little bit more edginess around it. You know, is it part of a bigger military deal that goes on with the region, all sorts of things? But the V&A is a nice, kind of pleasant institution that very successful and globally minded, but it feels it's probably more independent what it does. Is it good to have these direct exchanges, do you think?
I think for the institutions, it's probably very good in terms of trying to expand their global brand. I think in terms of the Louvre in Abu Dhabi not being, you know, the question of, as to whether or not it can be actually accepted as part of Emirati culture. I think, if I'm not mistaken, yesterday or 2 days ago, the cabinet held its meeting there, and it was that meeting coincided with National Day there. So it has been used for those purposes. In terms of the V&A in China, if I'm not mistaken, there is a there's also a similar design-oriented museum or creative culture museum that's going to be opening in October, excuse me, in Hong Kong next year. And that is, so perhaps there's a little bit of regional rivalry there. The V&A wants to get its foot in the door faster than the Chinese.
Yeah, and let's be honest, you know, the V&A will be helping, you know, British trade and British soft power.
It's definitely soft power.
There's always another current, it always feels, to all of these stories. Well, thank you very much. That brings us to the end, though, of today's show. James Rogers and Carlo Bonura, thank you very much for joining us here on Midori House. The show, well, it was produced by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and is also researched by Alessia Delania. And our studio manager was David Stevens. There's more music next, then at 1900 hours is our business show, The Entrepreneurs. And we're going to have more on the main stories of the day on the Monocle Daily, which is at 2200 hours. Midori House will, of course, be back at the very same time tomorrow, which is 1800 hours London time. But for me and Chuck, thank you very much for listening and have a great day. Bye-bye.